William C. Clark is with us. And, William, before the break, we said we'd talk about this this event. Let's start step by step, if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
You left Southern California to the desert. You got on I-40. You drove, I guess, on I-40 all the way to where the bridge incident happened, or did you take some detours?
Oh, I drove from California to Arizona to New Mexico to Texas.
Now you had an 85 Mustang?
Yes.
Was that yours? Or?
Yes, it was mine.
Was it tagged in New Mexico?
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, because the tags I had were paper plates, temporary tags.
Yeah.
And I didn't really want the tags to cost in California.
Yeah, I understand.
It's a lot more money than it is.
I lived in California.
Right. And so I stayed in a motel and stuff in New Mexico for a couple of days. And I used the address for the motel.
One of our producers said you were in Las Cruces. Is that right?
Yeah, I drove through Las Cruces.
Okay. Is that where you got the tag?
Actually, I got the tags in Albuquerque.
Okay. So he's on the ball.
Yes, he is.
Well, we're checking him.
Yeah. See, an 85 Mustang can't be smogged.
Yeah. So, okay. You were at the rest stop. You were in civilian clothes.
Yes, I was in my blue jeans, shirts, cowboy boots.
And how far is this rest stop from, for listeners around the world, from that bridge at Weber's Falls?
About six, 7 miles.
When you got back in your car and got back on the highway, had you realized something had happened?
Well, it was raining that day. And as I was driving, it was an exit for, I believe it was for Weber Falls, the Weber Falls exit.
Mm-hmm.
And the highway was blocked off by a city police officer. And at that time, I knew something happened. And I stopped up there and I asked the officer, hey, what happened? He said, the bridge is down, the vehicles are in the water. I said, well, I've went through training with Red Cross and stuff for emergencies. And if y'all need some help, I'd be more than willing to volunteer. And he said for me to go up to the bridge site and talk to Captain Harris.
Now, is this Captain Harris with the Oklahoma Highway Patrol or what?
Yes, he was the so-called incident commander of the Highway Patrol that's in charge of that scene at that time.
Okay.
So he had me go on forward. So I drove up the highway to the bridge scene. There was probably 4 or 5 Highway Patrol cars there. This was at, I got there about 7:15, 7:20 in the morning. I got out of my car. Nobody was up on the bridge site, up in the bridge.
The bridge literally had just fallen in, right?
Yes.
You could see the edge of it where you were probably.
Actually, you couldn't.
Oh, you couldn't. Okay, it was on downways.
Well, no, it was because how the bridge is elevated, you couldn't really tell that the bridge was collapsed right there.
So that explains the reason people were driving right off into the water.
Correct. And so I went down the left side of the bank area from the highway going down to the river.
You walked down there?
Yes. And when I got down there, I actually went into the water. And I rescued 2 people from there. And as I brought...
So you got down there and you saw people in the water?
No, there was cars in the water. I seen highway patrolmen and stuff on the other side of the bridge area, on the brink area.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't even paying attention to them. I was just caring about trying to save people's lives.
Were people yelling or screaming, or were they all underwater?
It was all underwater. All the vehicles were underwater. I went into the water and stuff to see what I could do. And I heard thumping, like someone's thumping on the window or on the hood, mm-hmm. on the top of the car or something.
So you already were an expert swimmer. You mentioned the Red Cross.
Yes. Yes, I'm in my travels around the world, I've learned how to scuba dive, surf. I've in Hawaii, everywhere.
So did you literally see people inside these cars?
You couldn't see inside the vehicles because...
It was really dark and muddy.
Well, yeah, it was muddy. The undercurrent was just ridiculous. You could probably see maybe 10, 12 inches in front of you, if you're lucky. And that's even if you had a mask on, a face mask. I didn't have face
mask. You didn't have anything, right?
No. And so I went just by noise and stuff and by the feel.
The water must have been cold.
Actually, it was probably about 40 degrees, 30, mm-hmm. 40 degrees. And so when I heard the thumping and stuff, I was able to break the window. And I got two people out of the vehicle. Got them up on shore.
Man and a woman or a man?
No, it was a woman and a daughter.
Okay.
After I got them up on the shore, the Highway Patrol was there and everything. And Captain Harris was there. And he refused to let me go back in the water to attempt to try and get anybody else out.
And what was his reasoning?
He said because the current was too strong. He said that he has experienced divers here, but nobody was in the water. I'm the only one that went in. He said if I wanted to help out, for me to go to the bridge site, to the docks in Weber Falls, to help secure the perimeter, to keep all the media and the civilians out of the area for just emergency personnel. I was like, fine. At least I was doing something.
Mm-hmm.
About maybe three and a half hours later, I seen the Highway Patrol and stuff just sitting on the shore. They haven't even went into the water yet.
So you're saying they didn't bother to go in the water for 3.5 hours? Or?
They didn't go in the water until probably about 6 to 8 hours later.
Hmm.
To even attempt it. Captain Harris of the Oklahoma Patrol, the incident commander, refused to let his men go in the water. He said due to, quote, in his own exact words, were the currents are too swift for his divers to go in. His divers are trained for emergency diving. They had scuba gear, they had their air tanks and everything in their vehicle. But he refused to let them go in.
About what time was it when you took the two people out of the car? 7:30, 7:45?
Between 7:45 and 8 o'clock.
Okay.
And
then you were ordered out of the water at that time?
Yes. I turned around and I went to Weber Falls to help secure the perimeter. Like I said.
Okay, now you were still in your civilian clothes.
Yes. Soaking wet, but I was still in my civilian clothes.
And you got in your car. You got in your Mustang and you drove down to Weber Falls.
No. Actually, I took a boat from the bridge site.
And now when you say you took a boat, what do you mean? Somebody said, come on, get in the boat?
I hopped a ride with a fisherman. See, that morning, they was having a fishing tournament.
You're right. I remember
there at
that
site.
So there were literally a couple of people that day.
Right, so there were literally between 40 to 70 boats in that area fishing in the tournament. So we had plenty of boats there.
So now, were you still in the water when this fisherman let you in the boat?
No, I was already out of the water. I was on shore.
And what'd you say? Hey, can I get in?
I asked if I can get right over to Britt, to the docks.
Okay.
And he said, yeah, no problem. So I rode over to the docks, left my car up there. And I had, there was a lady with the Red Cross that volunteered to go up to the bridge site and get my car and bring it down for me. Because I was helping out and stuff over there.
So somebody else went out to your car?
Yes.
You gave them your keys?
Yes.
Okay.
So she brought my car back. About 3.5 hours later, a fisherman came over. And he had a bag and stuff that had belongings in there. And there was the city police officer. There was a Muskogee County sheriff there that had taken inventory, taken possession of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked if I would help them tag it and stuff.
Now, you're still in civilian clothes.
Yes. I said, sure.
And what? These are just belongings of people?
Yeah, right, to help inventory and stuff, and document it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a camera that was in my car.
Right.
And they didn't have nothing to actually photograph anything. So I told the sheriff, the deputy, that he can go out to my car and grab my camera, my disposable camera that I had there. So he went out to my car and stuff and got the camera and came in. We photographed everything, wrote out everything on belongings. And in those belongings, there was a briefcase that belonged to a Captain Andrew Clements of the United States Army.
So this is how you knew about the United States Army captain.
Yes.
You didn't know about him beforehand.
No.
There have been no voices tell you about the United States Army captain dying and that you just were handed the stuff.
Now, yeah, it was.
This was like a briefcase. Did you open it?
Yes, we opened it. Me and the deputy sheriff and stuff.
They were all there. What was in it?
There were medical records, dental records for Captain Andrew Clements, his wife and four children.
No, nothing top secret.
No, and his travel orders and stuff. He was in transit.
From California.
To
the Pentagon, right?
To Virginia, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At that time, I got on my cell phone. And I contacted...
Now, were you in uniform at this point?
No.
Okay.
I contacted Fort Sill, Oklahoma, military police office. I told them exactly what happened and that I had these medical records and travel
records. No, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm just curious. How do you know these numbers? I mean, you call the operator and get information?
I called information.
Okay.
So I contacted them up, and they took my cell phone number, and they said that there'd be someone give me a call back. About 15 minutes later, I got a phone call back from a Lieutenant Colonel Sally from the Pentagon, from Casualty Assistance Office.
Well, that's pretty quick action.
Yes. She asked me if the body's been recovered and identified yet. I said, no, ma'am. No divers have been in the water yet. Nobody's been recovered yet. And she asked me if I would mind staying there until the body's been recovered and identified, and let her know.
And then call the Pentagon back.
And then give her a call back. I said no.
This is on a Sunday morning.
Yeah, this was the first day of the incident.
And so we're talking about probably...
I got the phone call around, I'd say, about 1:30, 2 o'clock.
So mid-afternoon there in Washington.
Yes. About...
So this Lieutenant Colonel probably was the... officer of the day or something.
No, she's actually in charge of the notification of
next of kin.
For
so somebody had called her and she and
Fort Sill contacted her.
Mm, okay.
10 minutes not 10 minutes later after I got a phone with her, I got a phone call from a Major Stevens of the Pentagon. As I guess that was one of his officers that he was reporting to, I'm not sure, asked me if the body's been recovered yet. I said no. He's like, well, do you mind staying there until the body's been recovered and identified?
So basically, he said the same thing the Lieutenant Colonel did.
Exactly. So I stayed there, and I went outside, and I still seen the highway patrol and stuff sitting on the site, on the shore,
drinking coffee and donuts. That Oklahoma Highway Patrol did nothing.
They didn't. I asked them how come they haven't gotten the water yet, and they said that the incident commander, Captain Harris, would not authorize them. Captain Harris had the dam shut down so that the water level could the water flow would slow down and also recede some before he allowed his divers to go in the water.
In your opinion, was the water dangerous and treacherous?
No. I turned around. I even told Captain Harris of the Highway Patrol that if he was worried about the current and stuff for his men, we have all these fishing boats there. It's not that hard to tie a safety line to the divers and attach them to the boats so that they won't get endangered.
Well, what's your opinion of this, Captain?
Personally?
Yeah, I mean...
He shouldn't... I don't feel like he should have been in high patrol. I don't feel that he should have been an incident commander.
Did you encounter him later? After all this is over?
No.
You've never heard or seen from him since?
No.
Okay.
4.5 hours later, after the initial bridge collapse, I talked to a guy named Mike with the emergency management services, and he said that Captain Harris hasn't contacted any federal agencies to get them on scene yet, and that he was trying to keep it in house. And I had got mad. Because he wouldn't let his divers go in the water. He wouldn't do anything. I got mad. I put on a set of fatigues.
I want to get into that when we come right back. This is what, about 6 hours later?
Yes.
I have lots of questions to ask about that. First of all, everybody's seen you not in the Army fatigues. Then you show up in the Army fatigues. I guess got to find out. We'll be right back, folks. I'm Jerry Pippin. I would like to take this opportunity to talk to you about a vacation idea for this summer, or really any time, that is unique, different, and affordable. I'm talking about a tour of the Grand Canyon in a van with Marvelous Marv, the world-famous tour guide. Marvelous Marv has lived in the Grand Canyon area for well over 2 decades, and he will show you things that no other tour guide will, and all the while fill you in on the history and the mystery of the giant canyon itself. When you go on a tour with Marv, you get to see the best viewpoints and the best exhibits. He knows this canyon. He knows this area of Arizona. Now on this page, there's a banner you can click on, and it will take you to Marv's website, where you can get all the answers about Marv and his Grand Canyon tour. This is a vacation you will treasure forever. Check it out, won't you? Marvelous Marv's Grand Canyon Tour. We're talking with William J. Clark, and what's the middle initial, J?
James.
And let's talk about why you decided to put the fatigues on, why you had the fatigues, the whole thing. You got upset because nobody, in your opinion, was doing anything to save anybody's life.
Exactly.
But by this time, 5 or 6 hours later, they're probably all dead anyway.
Well, it's not the point of that. See, there was 10 vehicles in the water. Six out of those ten vehicles that were recovered from that water, all their windshields were rolled up. Windshields were intact. There was no breakages. Except for the one vehicle out of the six that had the driver's side window busted out that I had done when I got the mother and daughter out. So those people died a slow, agonizing death. Those people could have survived in between 3 to 5 hours in that vehicle, because it's like turning, if you get a cup and you turn it upside down and you stick it in a sink full of water, you're going to have an air gap in the top of that glass from the pressure of the water. And that air gap's going to stay there for so long. In a vehicle, you're going to have an air gap between 18 to 36 inches. So between a foot to 2.5 feet.
Okay, now, a lot of attention's been focused on this Army captain that was deceased. And we talked a little bit about that, and we'll get back to that in a minute, but was it your idea to put on the uniform?
Yes, it was. I got mad. I seen that nobody was doing their job, and they didn't want to take anything serious. And the uniform that I had, I was doing stuff for the ROTC in California, my old school that I went to. And so I had...
When was that?
That was just a couple weeks prior.
Doing stuff with the ROTC, like what do you mean?
Well, they had a, a drill that they had, like state competition. All the different schools within the region would meet at the base over in Long
this
Beach.
This was your uniform?
Yeah, it was just a set of fatigues that had my name on it and stuff, and my ROTC.
What kind
rank
of rank did it have on it?
It had captain bars. So, and it had unit patches and stuff. So,
Well, now, this ROTC unit, where was this?
It was out of 29 Palms, California.
Okay.
And so, but I had on, but I had military unit patches on. So, and the unit patches were out of Fort Carson, Colorado, because I had a lot of friends. I still have a lot of friends there with Special Forces.
Yep.
I even got tattoos with them and stuff, so I even have my own Special Forces tattoo.
Did you ever try to join the Army?
Yes.
What happened?
They wouldn't let me because of my feet.
Your teeth?
No, feet.
Feet?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I get that.
But one thing about it is I grew up military.
Reason I was asking.
Yeah, it's like my whole life.
So obviously you knew how a captain should behave.
Exactly. But like I said, I got frustrated. I put on my uniform and I said that my name was Captain Clark, United States Army 10 Special Forces. I was hereby taken over. I got on my phone.
You had a Special Forces patch?
Yes. I got on my cell phone. I contacted the NTSB, which is the National Transportation Safety Board. I contacted the Corps of Engineers.
You mean they didn't know anything about it?
No.
The state of Oklahoma hadn't told them?
Exactly.
They hadn't turned the television on and watched CNN. It was all over the place.
CNN didn't even get notified until probably about 4 or 5 hours later. No news media was even there.
Well, I saw it on CNN that morning.
Right, but it wasn't until almost 11 o'clock in the morning when CNN...
It was earlier than that.
Okay.
But the point is, they told you they didn't know anything about it.
Exactly. So the NTSB, I contacted them, the Corps of Engineers, the Coast Guards. I even contacted the FBI, and I got them all on scene.
And you told them, this is Captain Clark?
I said, my name is Captain Clark. I'm here at the... over at the Weber Falls bridge collapse, the I-40 bridge collapse. And they were like...
Okay, now what about the people that you had seen earlier when you were in your jeans? Now all of a sudden you're in a captain's uniform. Anybody recognize you from earlier?
Yeah.
What'd they say?
They didn't say anything. They was just glad that somebody would step up to the plate and say, hey...
So in other words, you're saying nobody was in charge.
Nobody wanted to be in charge. They didn't want to have that responsibility at their feet.
How about the local people in Weber Falls? They didn't?
The mayor of Weber Falls turned around and even told the news media that I was in charge. And I helped set up contact line where they could contact there if they thought that...
So you really feel, even though you were being an imposter, you actually were doing some good.
Exactly. I even have a letter here in my wallet, which I even sent you a copy of.
Yes, uh-huh.
From a chaplain here in Oklahoma that was at the bridge scene. And he even said flat out that it wasn't the fact that I said that I was a captain of the military. It's just the fact that these federal agencies
right.
were there, that nobody wanted to take charge.
Nobody was taking the lead.
Exactly, and that's now, what I now, did when I said that I was a captain and everybody...
If I remember correctly, some real Army officers in the National Guard, I think it was a major, somebody came across you, right?
No.
No? A captain? You didn't run across any official Army people that took orders from you?
There was a sergeant and a corporal there.
No officers?
No officers. The only officers that showed up was from the Corps of Engineers, and that was a colonel who was at the bridge scene. And then there was Coast Guard who actually set up site, their own little shop.
How long were you out there in the boat? Were you ever on a boat in the uniform?
Yes, I was.
Okay, so
you literally
took command.
Yeah, along with an FBI agent and Highway Patrol.
Did the FBI agent question you? I mean, like, who are you?
No. They didn't ask for identification or anything.
You know where this FBI guy was? Was he from Muskogee?
No, he wasn't from Muskogee. He was from Oklahoma, I think Tulsa or something.
Okay. And you more or less had unchallenged authority at this point.
Exactly. Nobody challenged my authority at all.
I mean, you were getting calls from the Pentagon.
Yeah, and I was the governor of Oklahoma himself shook my hand on TV.
Well, I want to talk about that when we come back. Governor Keating, I understood And you actually told Governor Keating he couldn't have a press conference at a certain location. Is that right?
Actually, it is. He wanted to
admire you for your chutzpah.
Well, he wanted to have a press conference there at the bridge scene collapse area. And there was
the governor has official people with him. He has people from the Oklahoma National Guard with him, doesn't he? Or is it just state police?
State police.
Okay.
But one thing about it is that the governor, even though the governor is the governor of Oklahoma, that bridge collapse area is actually federal. It's actually falls under the National Transportation Safety Board, which is actually a federal agency, and therefore falls under federal jurisdiction.
Now, when were giving these orders, and the governor even was beginning to follow them, that had to feel pretty good. I mean, were you more in a mindset that you were just trying, nobody else was doing it, so you had to do it?
Yeah. It's not that I liked giving all these orders. My main objective was trying to save lives. All right, I try to get them to get divers in the water, but they wouldn't do it. This Captain Harris wouldn't let his people do it. So, in all reality, they're really at fault. This Captain Harris should have been went to prison too. He let those people die. In other words, it's basically population control. Take 9/11, for instance, okay? The federal government knew a year before it even happened. They knew the date that it was going to happen. There was even a big Senate oversight committee on it where the Central Intelligence Agency even admitted that they had information that was given to them a year prior. Even 6 months prior, they even had more information given to them.
Speaking of conspiracies, did you know there was a nuclear waste dump right across the river there?
No.
Did you ever know that during the whole time you were there?
No.
Did you ever meet that tugboat captain? The one that ran into the pier?
You mean the one that had alcohol on his breath?
Ran into the bridge.
Right. The one that was actually the...
Did you meet him?
No, I didn't personally meet him.
Okay. So you don't know if he had alcohol on his breath or not?
Oh, I know he had alcohol on his
breath. Well, if you didn't meet him, how do you know?
Because the EMT, one of the ambulance drivers, even said that and turned around, and the State Highway Patrol said they was just saying
would it surprise
that he just
you?
Fell asleep at the controls. And as he fell asleep, he hit the throttle on the tugboat, and he lost, and the boat just veered mysteriously to the right and hit the non-supported beam.
Would it surprise you if I told you that the tugboat captain had heard voices?
I wouldn't doubt it. The guy said that he hasn't slept in so many hours.
Oh, I don't know if he heard voices that say run into the the bridge. I'm just talking about in his history. He's heard voices.
I don't know.
Came out in court.
I know that they didn't charge him with anything.
Of course, you know, when things come out in court, you at first-hand experience, not much comes out in court.
Exactly.
It's pretty well controlled tightly in the federal system, especially by the judge and the federal prosecutor.
Yeah. And one thing about it is the federal system is so out of whack, the federal court system. You get more time for drugs or anything else than you do for rape, murder, or anything. I know there was in one of my prisons I was in, my federal prisons I was at, the guy was in there for it was voluntary manslaughter, and he only got 5 years. Guy got is also in there for possession of drugs. He got 27 years.
I used to do a comedy routine like that. Four guys in prison, one guy 5 years for manslaughter, 7 years for rape, 9 years for robbery, 26 years for stealing cable. You know?
Well, yeah, it's like, The federal, see, personally, I think, see, there was an article that me and this other guy did in prison that we actually wrote up. I've been trying to find it, but I can't find it, so I'm going to have to try and get in touch with him when he can send me a copy of it. And it talks about a way to help change the federal, to change the system, period. For every convicted felon, they have at least 2 to 4 relatives, family members or whatnot, that are voters. And every one of them people knows voters. If they go in there and they say, well, we ain't doing this anymore. We're not taking this anymore. And they pass that along. You're looking at 200 million voters in that racket alone. You're looking at, because there's over 267,000 federal prisoners, federal inmates. It don't matter if they're on probation or parole or if they're actually in federal prison. That's in the federal system, period. That are in federal prison, and roughly 240,000 of those inmates are nonviolent offenders. You get more time for nonviolent than you do for being violent. The federal courts and stuff, and the Senate, and these senators and congressmen and stuff are saying, foul, foul, foul. Okay? They're talking about budget, money, and everything else. They're talking about this immigration bill where they want to spend millions and millions of dollars. Well, heck. What's the whole ideal of having a federal prison system and throwing people in prison, federal prison, for nonviolent offenders when they can turn around and instead of making them a liability, help them become a productive citizen?
You know, that kind of let you out of the system, and you don't get much help. Do you?
I didn't get any help.
Do they give you any money at all when you get out of prison?
No.
You're just there, huh?
Exactly. See, the federal prison system, they're supposed to give you so much money and stuff, but they can give you up to $500. Okay?
They didn't give me nothing.
$500? No, they didn't give me anything. They didn't give me 1 cent. And that's because it's up. They leave that decision up to the warden of that prison. Instead of having it mandatory that each federal inmate that gets out of prison be given so much money. All depends on how much time they do in federal prison. Well, the wardens can say, no, I'm not giving them nothing. And they get away with it.
Let's get back to the situation there on the I-40 with the bridge collapsing and the deaths and the, as I alluded to, the nuclear waste dump right across the river. Be a good time to go get a few barrels of radioactive material, wouldn't it, Billy?
Yeah.
You didn't see anybody loading a truck up, did you?
No.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment. I'm Jerry Pippen.
The year was 1970 when Jack Blanchard and Misty Morgan released their first big single hit, Tennessee Birdwalk. For the first time in the history of music, this 45 RPM single becomes available to the public in the form of a mouse pad. Made of high-quality quarter-inch rubber, this fabric-covered 8-inch mouse pad delivers your mouse a very smooth ride. For only $9.95 plus $2.50 shipping and handling, your mouse pad will be rushed via USPS first-class mail. Simply click on the happy little mice and be directed to our ordering page. Hurry while this limited time offer lasts.
It's Tennessee Birdwalk. Choo-choo. It's Tennessee Birdwalk.